And now, with a roundup of things to watch out for from the Astronomical Society, here's Robert Massey.
One of the nice things that's coming up in the next couple of weeks is the departure of the Dawn mission, which is a NASA probe that's been studying two objects in the asteroid belt, from the fairly large object Vesta to head off towards another one, Ceres. Now, asteroids, I suppose the popular interpretation of those is that they're lumps of rock, you know, that there's not that much that's interesting about them. But actually, the big ones, the ones that are in predominantly between Mars and Jupiter, that we call main belt asteroids, can tell us an awful lot about the early solar system. And the reason is that they're far enough from the sun that they're not quite so affected by the heating of the sun. And yet they're also quite similar to the objects that went on to form the planets. And the Dawn mission's been studying Vesta for about a year now, and it's made some pretty amazing discoveries, actually. It's not a very big world. It's only about 550 kilometers across, but nonetheless, it manages to have an iron core inside, which suggests that at one time it had the whole sort of geological processes going on. In other words, a magma ocean, so liquid rock inside as well. It also has a mountain, which is 23 kilometers high, and that mountain is in the center of an impact crater, which is 90% as wide as the asteroid itself. So, you know, these are not boring places. I mean, fortunately, the good thing is that, you know, most of these very violent processes seem to have stopped now, but they've certainly had a very interesting past.
It sounds like an incredible technical and engineering challenge to be able to send something out to investigate one asteroid and then to be able to move it on to another one.
You're absolutely right. I mean, this is a multi-year, multi-target mission. And I think, you know, if you look at the kind of things engineers are able to achieve, you know, not just sending things into Earth orbit, but to the moon, the other planets, all the way out to Pluto in the next few years, to control them with such precision, to, you know, develop ion engines, literally almost electric engines that throw out charged particles at the back. And these probes can accelerate for a long time, very low thrust, but very efficiently. And they can carry on doing this sort of work for years and years. Now, I think it's an incredible achievement. And they bring them into within a sort of few hundred kilometers of the surface of these objects, you know, in some ways quite risky maneuvers. But most of the time, they get away with it, and they send back them at the incredible pictures we're used to. I think, really, on the whole, with the exception of Mars, which seems to be a very challenging target, once a space mission actually takes off, then on the whole, it's very likely to work.
So what are we expecting to see in the coming months? Will it be doing the same sorts of analysis that it was doing on Vesta?
Well, it actually takes 3 years to get there, so it comes back to that kind of engineering challenge again. It leaves Vesta and then it goes into an orbit which takes it slightly further away from the sun towards Ceres, the largest of all the asteroids that we know about, at least the ones between Mars and Jupiter. And it's big enough that it's also been classified as a dwarf planet as well, because it's fairly round and it's got some characteristics of a planet. And this world, it won't get there till February 2015, but it's considered to be very different. Vesta is quite dry. Ceres is seen as quite wet because there's a lot of evidence that it's got an awful lot of water ice there. And one suggestion I was reading a couple of papers earlier is that it actually has more fresh water locked up in its surface than the Earth does in all its oceans. So really quite an impressive figure. It's basically a combination of rock and ice, and therefore, you know, a really interesting target.
Now, that makes it sound a lot like a comet, and we've had other missions to actually land on the surface of comets as well. So are we actually going to learn more about this slightly hazy definition between what's a comet and what's an asteroid?
There seems to be quite a lot of debate about this. I mean, you can sort of define comets as being worlds that are very, very icy, and, you know, that they tend to be rather smaller as well, and they tend to be in quite eccentric orbits that bring them in close to the sun. But there are exceptions to that, and there are undoubtedly crossovers. So I think, you know, who knows, maybe if you did bring Ceres towards the sun on a sort of much more, an orbit that perhaps crossed the orbit of the Earth, then you would see it developing a tail. I mean, having said that, it's probably a good thing it doesn't, because I don't think I really want a 1,000-kilometre world careering around the inner solar system.
So now, going from a mission that we're looking forward to seeing in the future to some stuff that's already been published, what exciting news has come out recently?
Well, there's a couple of really nice science stories that have come out in the last couple of weeks. One of them is about a precursor to a so-called supernova star. Now, we see supernovae, very, really cataclysmic explosions all the time, but they're generally in quite distant galaxies. It's just simply that these stars reach the end of their life. They end their lives very violently, and you see this brilliant, well, I'd say flash, but it usually lasts for weeks, months at a time as the explosion fades away. It's actually quite difficult to know exactly which stars are going to go through this process. There's two main types of supernova. The most common one, type 2 and 1b and 1c, and they're described as, are where you have a very, very massive star that runs out of fuel, and because it runs out of fuel, the pressure outwards, the heat, the engine basically in the center stops working when nuclear fusion shuts down, and the core collapses and the star is destroyed in a really violent rebound. There is another type, which is often brighter and somewhat different, which is where you have a binary star system. You have one star that's usually quite a giant star for one reason or another, close to a so-called white dwarf star. And a white dwarf is the remnant that you'll get after the sun exhausts its fuel and reaches the end of its life. But if you have a large star near one of these in a binary system, the strong gravitational pull of the white dwarf can drag material off it. And over a period of hundreds of thousands, millions of years, there can be so much material piling up that you get a very, very violent explosion. And in extreme cases, an explosion that's violent enough to destroy the whole system. And these are of great interest to astronomers because they seem to take place when the mass accumulated by the white dwarf is about the same. And what that means is that the violence, the explosion, and the brightness of it is about the same as well. But it's very difficult to know which stars are actually going to do this. And a U.S. group has found an object called QU Carini, and they've looked for signs that it's about to go into this phase. Now, you can sound very alarmist when you say that kind of thing. This object's a long way off, and when I say about to, you know, you're probably talking any time within the next million years. But it does seem to be going through the initial stages of reaching this point. And if that's confirmed, and I'm sure the scientists would be delighted if it became a supernova in the next few years, because they'd probably win a Nobel Prize for being some of the first people to predict one. But it would be the first time that we've seen this kind of object and made that sort of prediction. So it's interesting stuff. I mean, the purposes of history, the last time one like this was visible to the naked eye was right back in 1572, when people, including Tycho Brahe, who is very famous for cataloguing a lot of the positions of planets and stars, saw one at the end of the 16th century then. So, but incredibly bright object, and it's close enough that, you know, it would be visible in the sky for months, and much brighter than Venus and so on.
On now to something that actually, instead of putting a constraint on our understanding of the universe, it puts a constraint on our viewing of our own Milky Way. Light pollution is, of course, a big problem for people who want to see the stars, but it seems now that it's changing.
Light pollution is absolutely the bane, certainly, of amateur astronomers' existence, and I would also argue a lot of professional astronomers are affected by it. You know, particularly in the United States, where the major observatories, say in southwestern Arizona, find their view is affected by some of the big cities nearby, like Los Angeles and so on. But yes, that's right. There's a group in Berlin, or a couple of groups in Berlin, that have worked together to measure the color of the night sky and measure the brightness of the night sky. And they've produced a paper called Red is the New Black. It's by a guy called Christopher Kyber of the Free University in Berlin. And he's discovered that, yes, that the night sky is redder than it used to be, which is no great surprise because we've got all the lights, the street lights across Europe and across the world that are causing that. But also, he's predicting and measuring a change that suggests it's getting somewhat bluer over time. He's developed a detector, and he thinks that as we replace the sort of standard orange lights that we're familiar with in our cities with more modern LEDs that look a bit whiter and have a somewhat bluer color, that the color of the night sky is starting to mimic that. And if you think about the way this technology is coming in, it's probably only going to be a decade or two before that takes place across the world. And so instead of a red night sky, you end up with a blue one. Now, aesthetically, that might sound a little better, but the impact might be even worse, in the sense that if you mimic a blue color in the sky, it may be much worse for wildlife that, you know, basically sees some of the characteristics of daylight in that. So they are concerned about it. They're arguing very carefully, saying, look, you know, this is an unpredictable thing that's going on here. We don't know what the consequences will be, and that it's very important that if you design these lights, which most people prefer because you can see more easily, at least make sure that you don't scatter light up into the night sky. It's the usual stuff about good practice and making sure that they're shielded so you light up the ground rather than the sky above you.
Even without the new LED technology, we ideally want to reduce the amount of light that goes upwards, it goes skywards. Are there certain tricks, certain engineering adaptations that we can make to try and reduce the level of light pollution at the moment?
Well, there are some really simple things that can be done, and some local authorities in the UK have done this, where, you know, they protect observatories, for example. But you can cut them off. You can put a shield over it, a reflecting shield, which directs the light downwards. So all it does, instead of scattering up, you know, I mean, I suppose if you look out of your bedroom window and you're near a street light, you see the light shining in, that can be reduced. And more importantly, it doesn't actually throw the light right up into the night sky. So it's less wasteful as well, because the light goes where you want it to. If it's reflected down onto the ground rather than illuminating the air above, that's got to be a good thing. It, you know, in theory, at least, it can help cut energy bills too.
Robert Massey from the RAS.